We're going to get into a little probably different dynamics than what you've had before, is that I'm going to talk about conservation management, but I'm going to link it back to physiology and environmental responses of different agroecosystems and all of this from that perspective of how do we really need to be thinking about conservation management and conservation agriculture. And I want to start off with this slide that Ratan Lal just put together and is published in the July issue of the Journal of Soil Water Conservation. And to use this as a template to show that conservation agriculture is not going to occur with one step. Everybody thinks that we go out and we put conservation agriculture in and automatically all is good. But in reality, the beauty of this diagram shows that it is a building process as we go along. As we go from adding that simple little change of adding mulch to the system, what do we do in terms of soil and water conservation? You put cover cropping into that or diverse rotations. What do we do in terms of nutrient responses? In a little more complex rotation, what do we do in terms of breaking life cycles of pests and diseases and the environmental quality impact? And then you get into integrated nutrient management and all of this. And finally, you get to this point of really what is there in terms of conservation agriculture. But it's not the first step in all of this. And so what I built is another piece of this, and what I call the soil aggregation ladder, is the fact to explain to producers that it is not a simple process. And it takes energy, and it takes time, and it's like going to the gym on the Stairmaster. And everybody runs to the gym to go to the Stairmaster, right? You look at all this because it's hard work, but the first step in all of this is how do we stabilize the soil microclimate to allow the biology to do its thing? Because unless we do that, we don't see the benefits of all of this. And so we broke it out in terms of biological activity, and then there's these invisible and dynamic processes that go on. We've got organic matter turnover, we've got improved nutrient cycling is all of this process. And then you get to the visible outcomes of all of this, and that's improved soil structure, improved water availability. And at the end of this very arduous climb out there is that we improve efficiency, we improve yield, we improve environmental quality, we improve profit and all of this. But it's a step. It's a stair step that we go through, and all of this, the same thing that Ratan showed, we get to conservation agriculture. It is not just one piece. It's a long process that we go up. The stairs are a process that we go up, and it takes energy, mental energy, to begin to do this overall piece of it. So if you look at conservation agriculture and you look at building this overall process, we need to understand these dynamics. But if you look just simply, if you look at the physiological responses of what happens in this, we get improved growth because we have better water, we have better soil gas exchange, and we have a reduction of temperature extremes in the root zone. And it's the first piece that we talk about more than the other two, but the other two are actually more critical. Gas exchanges that go back and forth, both oxygen as well as CO2, are very, very critical. And we need to have much more understanding of just what the oxygen dynamics are within soils. The reduction of temperature extremes, I'll show you some dynamics of that as we go forward. That becomes an interesting piece of this, because I'll leave you with this place is that I think our soils are too warm in the upper Midwest. Everybody wants their soils to warm more quickly. I think that's actually what is screwing up a lot of our problems that are out there, and I'll kind of put that together for you. The environmental responses that we see within all of this: improved infiltration, reduced erosion both from water and wind, and improved water storage within that profile. And so water, environmental, physiological, all those things that we can bring together. So we'll start off with a simple little box. And we'll just talk about evapotranspiration as this overall water dynamic. The first three boxes that are across there, the energy input, the water vapor gradient, wind speed gradient, those are atmospheric demand. You're not changing those. Those are really what the atmosphere wants from the system. What it actually gets is that little box at the end, the soil water availability. Unlike the federal government, you can only spend what water you have in the soil profile. Okay? We cannot deficit spend soil water. We can't borrow against next year's. We can't even borrow against July's if we're in June. And so what really controls our overall process is how much water we have in the bank. And that's really a function of how we manage our soils, both in terms of organic matter content, infiltration rates, storage, water capacity of that plant to explore that profile and everything else. But that box at the end is our rate limitation in this overall piece of this puzzle. And if we just look at this, and this is still the slide from Hudson, looking at this, and some people argue that that's not the exact, and there's a lot of variation around this line, but it does point out that the more organic matter we can put in the soil, the higher our available water holding capacity, both from an infiltration rate as well as storage within that. But I'd also argue that the more efficient we make that system, because if we don't disturb the soil, we allow the roots to go down deeper in all of this. But we improve our soils because we're not going to change precipitation availability. You're not changing the precipitation pattern or how much you get. The only thing you can manage is the soil. We can reduce the E out of ET component. We can reduce the evaporation component that allow more of that water to go into ET. And we can reduce soil water evaporation from the surface by anywhere from 50 to 100% in this whole puzzle. But we also can increase just that simple change is we can increase the availability of water and temperature to improve the soil biology within that profile because that's the piece that allows us to do different things along the way. And you just look at this, we degrade our soils, we go downwards, we improve our soils, we go upward in terms of the process. And so this available water capacity, I think, still needs to be a dynamic that we look at in terms of the process. But if you look at conservation agriculture and what we do and how it affects both physiologically as well as environmentally, is reducing the number of tillage passes does have a positive impact. We also reduce the cross-sectional size of that area of that tillage that's out there. And maintaining that surface residue is critical from a number of different viewpoints, both from protection against these high-intensity rainfall events that we see more and more of, also reducing the evaporation rate, increasing and maintaining the soil biology within the soil to allow that those pieces to occur is absolutely critical. That's why that first step is there, because soil biology is just like you and I. They don't like change. You know, and they really don't like to be disrupted. And so when we disrupt them, we basically destroy their environment. We put them through extremes that they don't want to work in. And then they basically just give up and disappear. And then we wonder what happened to our soil as well. And then ultimately we decrease soil water evaporation and we increase the soil water infiltration rates from that process. Some data from Don Rakowski. This is three different systems. The blue line on that is water evaporation. The hashed lines are CO2 released back to the atmosphere. If we don't disturb it at all, there's a little bit of water going on, basically five times as much when we do broadcast tillage. That's what that is in there. If we do a low disturbance tillage, this is ultimately strip till or a very narrow slot tillage. We still evaporate some water out there. We always do, but we don't change the CO2 very much in that, particularly if we don't disturb the old root row. If you work in between the rows, you see even less reduction of CO2 coming out. Show you how dramatic this is. If you look across the Midwest after corn harvest, is that our atmospheric concentrations of CO2 go to about 400 parts per million. That's what the atmospheric concentration that is. Until we begin to aggressively till in the fall, and then those CO2 concentrations bump up to anywhere from 550 to 600 parts per million. In a few week period, we basically take all the CO2 that we put below the root system and put it back to the atmosphere and wonder why we can't change the organic matter content in our soils. We cannot change the organic matter content and still we stop reducing the amount of tillage that we do in this. A rule of thumb that we use is that every time we till in the spring, it's a half inch of water evaporated to the atmosphere. Two tillage operations is basically an inch of water and it's out of the root zone. 2012 taught farmers a lot of that lesson from that viewpoint. So conservation agriculture, we look at it from a physiological and the environmental point of view, is in the short term, we do reduce the soil water evaporation. So we maintain really near the surface. In fact, what we see is that because we do change that and we have water available surface, is that we have roots that are very near that surface to take up a lot of nutrients and water right below the residue layer in that. We increase the infiltration rates as well as irrigation events if we maintain that, because we absorb the raindrop energy and allow that to move through. Our soils have become so fragile that we see runoff events occur with less than an inch of water per day, not per hour, per day, in terms of how fragile our soils and how quickly they seal. So we, and the other piece of this is we actually increase the efficiency of small rainfall events because we get these quarter inch, half inch rains that goes through the residue. Since those roots are right up near the surface, we can pick that water up and utilize it very efficiently, and we reduce the overall rate of evaporation if the plants are growing in standing stubble as well. Long term, we do improve the water holding capacity. We've changed organic matter within fields by how we look at this, and in the consequence of that is we've reduced the yield variability on half-mile rows to less than 20 bushels per acre. That's a pretty remarkable change from a lot of the farmers run 150 to 200 bushels across the half-mile row. We increase the water availability of that crop in the long term, and we increase the rooting depth. Plants are lazy. They're just like your kids. Is that they really will follow an old root channel before they'll send the energy to grow down through a new piece of the soil. And so what we see when we start digging pits in long-term conservation agriculture is that those old root channels that are there and been undisturbed, much darker along the edges of them, roots are down through there. We'll pick up rooting depths down to 5, 6, 7 feet without any problem in there, because they'll automatically follow that and then they decay, and there's a lot of microbial activity around that as well. But in all of this, let us remember the fact that it's not just water, and it's not just nitrogen, and it's not just carbon. It really is this carbon, water, nitrogen cycle that we talk about. And just this simple diagram for agriculture is that we drive all this with solar radiation. We do have a lot of different processes that go on above and below ground. And so when we really start talking about the benefits of this process, how we change the soil surface and how we change that upper piece of this does have impacts all the way across. We spent a lot of time looking at really where does our yield go, and we look at different systems, and this just happens to be an analysis that we've done for Story County. This the solid line across there is the actual county yields since 1950. The upper line is a statistical fit through the upper quadrant points, and the dashed line across there is the yield gap, the difference between that solid line and the actual yields. But then if we look at it on a frequency analysis, we find that we're losing about 80% of our yield 20% of the time, or 20% of the yield 80% of the time, due to short-term stresses. This is not the drought of 2012. This is the short-term stress really is we needed an inch and a half of water that week when we only got 3/4 of an inch. And so we end up with that. And if you look at the overall pieces of this puzzle, it really gets to the point that reduced tillage is really coming from this protective blanket. And when we look at this overall dynamic of how we look at that yield response curve, and we've actually done this for all 646 counties for the Midwest, so that's just not one piece of the puzzle that's out there. We see that same thing over and over again. And so as we think about this, it's really about this protective blanket, both from a water dynamic, a temperature dynamic, all of this, and stabilizing it. So this, we always talk about residue on the surface, and it's really about stabilizing that microclimate. That physiological response that we see in a plant is really about how we've stabilized that microclimate below the surface that allows the biology to work from many different perspectives. And we see it, this is just one example where we've changed the biology of the soil by adding a biological fertilizer. And this is a simple relationship, just looking at the leaf chlorophyll analysis late in the season, is that that additional biological activity, mineralized nitrogen, put it back in there, and that's why you see the additional greenness in there. And in fact, we build it up in such a way that the longer we can keep that plant green, the higher the yield. So we build a little chlorophyll summation index that we just go and can look at that and begin to show producers that here is the value of what you do and what it means in all of this. We've done other things with biological activity within this. Just happens to be an experiment we ran with 14-inch by 24-inch columns of soil. They have CO2 sensors. They have all sorts of other sensors in them. The big line on the top is where we've added the biological system. That is the CO2 evolution. The lower lines is where we've added all sorts of different things. We set this experiment up so we could look at beginning on what happens when we begin to do all sorts of different things to the soil in this. And this is just the difference between a biological fertilizer and a commercial fertilizer and the amount of CO2 that gets evolved. And we get to see the real response of that biology in very different ways in all of this. And we see it both in a lab, within the field as well. We see increased CO2 uptake when we go into the field environment, when we begin to look at what that canopy is really doing as well. The environmental response that we see out there is that we do reduce erosion, we increase this water storage, we decrease leaching because we're changing the whole dynamics of this, and we actually decrease greenhouse gas emission from this viewpoint as well. Because here's why it becomes important. And these are the top three insurance claims across the Midwest. The top two insurance claims: excess moisture, drought. 55% of the claims in the Midwest are those two claims, and they are related to how we manage the soil. And so if we can improve our soils, we could basically improve this, because that dynamic and what I showed before in terms of where we're losing yield and all of this is related to that dynamic. And so if we just invested $12 billion in soil management since 89, we'd have probably changed the whole dynamics of the upper Midwest. And the question really becomes, how much is tolerable in terms of erosion? This is 2013 across Iowa, when we had our schizophrenic year, really wet spring, really dry summer. That's when meteorologists coined the term flash drought. It's because we went from wet to dry so quickly in all of this. These just happens to be scenes across Iowa. We can see the same thing for 2014. We see the same thing in 15. We're seeing more and more of this. But Iowa is not supposed to be a wind erosion state, but we see that as well. This happens to be a field just south of Ames. That estimated wind erosion when we did the calculations is 3 tons per acre in terms of wind erosion across Iowa. And we're not a wind erosion state. So, you know, we're going to have to think differently about this puzzle in terms of the dynamics. Here's the other false assumption, is that we say we have limited amounts of erosion, we can keep it at this the tolerable soil loss. 4 tons per acre, that's that little pound of soil over there, but if you farm for 40 years, that's the mountain of soil that comes off that 1 acre. That really gets to the point of why we need to think about this, not from a one-year perspective, but from a multiple-year perspective, because we really are thinking about how do we improve our soils, how do we keep it in place, and how do we allow it to work that way. Nitrous oxide emissions, if you think about this, this is a stylized curve, just looking at the dynamics, is that when you look across the literature, nitrous oxide is basically at 70% water-filled pore space. The more we improve our soils, the higher water we can have in there and still have 70%. So we don't change the, we really do influence the nitrous oxide in there. One of the pieces that we haven't looked at very specifically that I think is leading to the excessive moisture complaint or the claim is that we really haven't valued the oxygen exchange between the soil and the atmosphere. That excessive moisture claim is really a surrogate for the lack of oxygen in the root zone. And we keep that upper surface stabilized. The oxygen exchange goes back and forth very, very rapidly. You begin to do that, and so we've actually added oxygen sensors to all of our field experiments this summer to start looking at the dynamics of those, because you have a hard time finding anything in the literature on that dynamic. And I think it's going to become a critical piece of how we value soil health and how we value the physiological response of that plant. So conservation agriculture does improve the physiological responses because we see improved soil water dynamics. And we see the improved soil water dynamics, the temperature dynamics that go along with stabilizing this the soil microclimate that allows that biology to do itself, work itself in such a way that we improve the nutrient cycling within that. We see better uptake of nutrients within this plant system. All of that feeds into this overall aspect of how do we improve our soils, but also how do we improve and drought-proof our systems? How do we make them less vulnerable to all the extremes of weather that we go through during a season? This aggregate stability is probably to refocus on the upper half inch of soil, not the upper 6 inches, because that upper half inch is the gateway between the soil and the atmosphere. And stabilizing that is going to become very critical. If we measure it at 6 inches of depth, we dilute that out. So this upper half inch becomes very, very critical in all of this. And that really does minimize the environmental impact because we reduce the runoff, we reduce the leaching, we improve the nutrient cycling, all of these different things. But it's not about one simple change. It's about a complex set of interactions that go on that start with how we look at this system, how do we value this system, and how do we begin to look at different metrics along the way. So with that, thank you.
Probably have time for maybe just one question before we go to the next one.
Yeah, what was in that perfect blend?
That's a composted chicken litter with, we actually have 3 bacillus species in that, and it has a some micronutrients along with it.
So you've got a great view of all the research that's out there. If you could be king for a day, what do you think are still some of the gaps that we need to fill for the benefit of growers trying to make these decisions? Where do you think we got to work?
Ooh, that's...
Well, if you were king for a week, then...
Well, yeah, that... I take all of Wayne's budget and, you know. yeah. Easy come, easy go. It really is, when you start getting with the producers, it's really about showing the value of these things in such a way and showing them that it's not simply one thing. And that's really where we've had a lot of traction with them. And a lot of times we've had to spend time digging pits, showing them these dynamics in the field to show them that here is the result of what you've done. In this. I mean, when they see water erosion across the field, you know, and stabilizing that soil to show that it's not running off and keep it in place. I'll give you the one example where we've worked with a young producer that's up by Sioux Center, is that we changed his practices, he and his dad's practices, to from where they were at with broadcast application of manure. We went with a split application or a strip application of manure and didn't just between the rows, moved it back and forth, put a lot of testing into that so we could look and see what happens. That's all implanted right on that strip the next spring. Is that his yields have increased from an average of about 180 to about 240. But the more important part is that when we run the combines back and forth, is that we're picking up less than 20 bushels on half-mile rows on the variation. I mean, you go in any part within that field that you dig, it basically all looks the same. And we're talking about 18 inches of topsoil. I mean, we've really dramatically changed that in a quick period of time in all of this. And I think we have to work with producers to show them that it does work on their system, and it can work in that way. And here's the principles behind it, but how you begin to apply it to your system is where it's critical. And I think that, I think we have the knowledge to do this. I think it's a matter of how do we get it producers convinced that it does make them more money, and it does alleviate some of the variations that they have, because what producers really want is stabilized yields over time.
Yeah, right.
And all of this is how do you stabilize the yields that happen. So.
Thank you.